Thank you so very much for both the offertory music and the special music. They add a lot to our service. Very meaningful words for this last song as well. And the offertory music took my wife and I back a number of years. We both have played clarinets. In fact, we sat next to one another at Ambassador College in the band and, you know, not whistled Dixie, but played clarinets. So that gave us opportunity for friendship, et cetera, as the time went on. Cancel that one. I shouldn't have said that. Too late. Too late. It's out. What's different? What's different about today compared to the other annual holy days of God? Not a difficult question, is it? Today resounds with the sound of trumpets. Trumpets in the plural. Not that none of the other days have any kind of connection, but there is such an emphasis on this. So let's read about it back in Leviticus chapter 23, that well-known to most all of us chapter of the Bible where God gives a listing of His feast days, His holy days. And I emphasize that because too much of the world about us, if they pay any notice to days such as today, they're likely to say, that's antiquity. That's a group of people, you know, that this was given to thousands of years ago, those Israelites. But that's not for us today. Those are Jewish days, many will say, won't they? And you can read that written many times about the annual festivals and holy days of God, the insinuation that they are only for the Jewish people. Notice that God differs with this. As He gave this instruction, He spoke to Moses, eternal God spoke to Moses in verse 1 of Leviticus chapter 23, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feast of the eternal. Did we get that? Don't we wish more people would understand this distinction? That God says, they're my feasts. And there was no distinction at that time, you know, among the descendants, the tribes, the sons of Israel, in terms of mainly one of them, like Judah, being called Jews. It was Judah. It was years later, and you read that, you know, in historical book, like in Kings, where at a particular time, years and years later, the ones from Judah, and had a few additions from Benjamin and such along with them, but primarily the tribe of Judah, they were at war with the northern tribes of Israel. Hundreds of years later, they were at war with them. And that's first reference in the Bible to them being called the Jews. Hundreds of years later. So it even misses as far as the time setting. There was no distinction at that time for one of the tribes of Israel just to be over here. They were together. He says, proclaim, you shall proclaim to be holy convocations. These are my feasts, God says. And He starts off, interestingly enough, with the weekly Sabbath. The weekly Sabbath. Every Sabbath day, seventh day of the week. And then He goes on into the annual ones. The feast of the Lord, the holy convocation that you proclaim in their appointed time. Then He starts off with the Passover and then with the days of unleavened bread. And then later on, more down toward the middle of the chapter, the feast of weeks, feast of first fruits, New Testament terminology, more commonly feast of Pentecost. And then we got get on down here to the beginning of the listing of the fall festivals and verse 23. So this is easy to remember, where it tells us about this distinction for the Feast of Trumpets. Leviticus 23, verse 23. From then the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, on the first day of the month, you shall have a Sabbath rest, a memorial of blowing of trumpets, a holy convocation. Quite a bit jam-packed, as it were, into what we have as one verse, isn't it? Here it is. Again, when it is, beginning of the seventh month, the Hebrew calendar, the first day of the month, you shall have a Sabbath, a memorial. What is a memorial? A memorial is something that it is set aside to be a reminder, to be a reflection, to think back. You know, we have Memorial Day in this nation. Other nations have some similar thing. You know, and we have lots of things that are memorials. Well, this is a memorial. This festival that we're keeping today is a memorial of blowing of trumpets. Again, notice the plural there. It's not just blowing one trumpet one time. Blowing of trumpets, a holy convocation. So this day has quite a distinction. Now, you know, this is the central, pivotal, focal holy day in the plan. What does all that mean? Well, it means that the first part of God's plan, as reflected in that which comes earlier, and God uses, as most all of us understand well, the agricultural cycle, you know, that was there in the Holy Land, Palestine name later for it. But the spring of the year, like Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread, and going on, and now we make a shift. We pivot. We pivot, beginning with this festival, this holy day, this convocation called the Memorial of the Blowing of Trumpets. So we call it trumpets. You know, we're familiar with Rosh Hashanah and that terminology for today. But it is a pivot in regard to God's plan. It starts off, you know, in the spring of the year. And it starts off with the Passover, the Days of Unleavened Bread. We know what they picture. I'm not going to go through all of those. But those things are very much oriented for the first fruits in God's plan at this time. There's application coming for all who have not had their opportunity at a future time. But there needs to be a people, a first fruit group of people. You know, Jesus Christ came at his first coming, as we can call it, for a number of reasons. To die, to pay the eternal death penalty for sin, was a huge one, a prominent reason. But that wasn't the only reason. There are seven or more reasons that we could easily identify. And another one of those reasons was to train his disciples. And they were instrumental. You know, we had the 12, and we understand that Judas Iscariot had difficulties, and, you know, he got in the wrong attitude and allowed Satan to influence him, and he betrayed Christ. He needed to be replaced, and we find in Acts chapter 1 that indeed he was. Matthias, the one that replaced him. So the training of a small group of disciples, but they weren't the only ones who were being trained in a broader sense. There was a larger group, like the 120. And then there were additional ones. And so we come to the day of Pentecost when, you know, God had been working also with individuals, a number of individuals from the various other nations that came in to Jerusalem, as we read in Acts chapter 2, for that day of Pentecost, the time when God gave his Spirit as a begettal. And so God is doing something, as reflected by the earlier festivals and holy days in his plan, in regards to starting small with the first fruits. But now we shift. We make this pivot. The focus changes, beginning with today. What about the rest of the world? That question begs an answer, doesn't it? How could a loving, merciful God, people sometimes say something like this, allow such suffering, such agony, such horrendous decimation of human life. And you know, the history of humanity is replete with that. We can't enumerate it. We can't begin to comprehend how many millions and billions have died through violent means. Supposedly, by some of those who have tried to figure out, you know, how many of the, say, the last 6,000 years or so have been years of relative peace, and that's kind of pushing words there, I guess. But instead of outright war, guess which one is predominant? War! Those that I've read about that have tried to do a little study have come to the conclusion that humanity has been at war so much more than at peace. Well, why is that? Remember that scripture in the book of Isaiah, and the way of peace. Isaiah 59, verse 8, I think it is. The way of peace they've not known. And the Apostle Paul quoted that passage in Romans chapter 3 as well. And so we pivot now with the beginning with this day. And this day is so jam-packed with meaning. I'm going to give it a shot this morning, you know, in addition to the sermonette that we had. And then the speakers this afternoon will have to take it from there. And I think those two guys, Mr. Harmon and Mr. Light, are going to have their hands full, because we'll leave a lot uncovered. I'm joking a little bit. But, you know, my point is that there's so much to this. So much. And it's good for us to review this. Even if we've been around for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, maybe we better stop, number of years, you know, and this has been familiar to us. It's good to review, isn't it? It's good to review these things and the wonderful plan of salvation that God has for humanity. Now in Zechariah chapter 14. Zechariah chapter 14. We notice that God places an emphasis, you know, upon his days. And historically, for the nation of Israel, the Feast of Tabernacles was such a joyous occasion. I've read a little bit about it. Many of you have read a little bit about it. And, you know, for years, actually decades, I was waiting, kind of figuratively chomping at the bit to go to Israel there in the Middle East, and in particular, Jerusalem, and to reflect. And one of the times that we were there, what was that, about 6 years ago now? We were there for Pentecost. Haven't been there at Feast of Tabernacles time. But the point I'm making is that there was such jubilation in that Feast of Ingathering, another name for the Feast of Tabernacles, that the population just swelled, you know, from all the people coming in from surrounding areas. And what a sight that must have been to see them make their pilgrimage to the feast where God had set his name in Jerusalem. And they came in and, you know, they spent those days together and rejoicing. We have some different situations today, but the same injunction is there for us to rejoice before God at all of his times. But here in Zechariah chapter 14, verse 16, it shall come to pass that everyone, that's all inclusive, right? Everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem. That's also thought provoking when you tie in, you know, the blowing of the trumpet, trumpets in plural, and the indication of the numbers of people that will die prior to the second coming of Messiah. Just massive carnage that will take place. But there will be those who are left. Of all the nations, it will come to pass that who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to worship the King, the Eternal of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And of course, it goes on and it says that this is not just an invitation and take it or leave it. This is a command. Will be a command. And it gives an illustration, quite vivid. If the nation of Egypt, you think that could be a possibility? Well, maybe so. The nation of Egypt, for example, said, hey, we don't need that. Just like historically, Egypt has relied upon the Nile River. Who needs rain like these other countries? You know, we can get water from the Nile River and irrigate and grow crops and all of that. There are all the nations are going to be instructed, and Egypt is singled out as a possible example for the future. If they refuse, they will receive plagues. More than a subtle encouragement to change their mind and to keep God's festival. I've titled this sermon, What is the Significance of the Feast of Trumpets? What is the significance of the Feast of Trumpets? The New Testament church had an understanding that they were part of the first fruits in God's plan. Now, they didn't know when Jesus Christ would return, did they? They say, well, why didn't they know that? Well, it wasn't intended by Almighty God that they know and understand that. And when they asked, Jesus Christ did not give them the kind of answer that apparently they wanted to know. Like, are you ready now? Acts chapter 1, is that this the time when you're going to restore Israel? And Jesus Christ said, you've got a work to do. I've commissioned you to go out and do a work. And so we're in the same boat, figuratively, in terms of not knowing the exact time. We do know we're a lot closer to it than the disciples or apostles were, right? Because we're close to 2,000 years down the line. But nonetheless, if we're too interested in knowing the exact time, we just might have a little problem, like kind of was alluded to in one part of the sermonette. You know, you could fall asleep, literally, or more importantly, spiritually, if you just think, oh, I got lots of time, because I don't know when we get close. Well, not a good way to think about all of these things. So as we go on into the plan of God and look at this day of trumpets, we find that the events, and these are powerful, mind-boggling events that take place. And some of them, bam, 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 you know. And this trumpet sounds. And then this huge event takes place. And I think my sense of it, I was overwhelmed when I first started reading some of that, especially getting on into the book of Revelation and some of those things, you know, in Revelation chapter 6 and 7 and 8 and on into chapter 9. And seeing all of these things, and there won't be anybody left. Look at that. That's a third of this and this and this. We come to a better understanding as we get more of the information in our minds. But this day of trumpets then also presents an expansion and an extension of the many events. So they're introduced in regard to the Feast of Trumpets and the sounding of the trumpets. But they carry forward into time beyond that. So that aspect also makes this a focal, pivotal holy day. We look back to the earlier part of God's plan, but we look forward to what God is going to do to bring about the changes, huge, monumental changes that will take place. One of those huge changes will be removing Satan. The binding of Satan, you know, mentioned at the beginning of Revelation chapter 20, for 1,000 years. And as Christ is ruling and reigning over the earth, I think this is hard to imagine, because you or I could try to talk to somebody about some of the things that we're blessed to understand, and it might not end up being such a wise thing. You know, they might say, I don't care anything about that. That's foolishness to me. So our minds need to be open. But one of the great dangers, I think, brethren, that we have is the danger in becoming judgmental and critical of others. This goes right down the line of what human nature's tendencies oftentimes are. And I think, you know, the Jewish people have struggled some with this too. Because when you have a calling, when you have special insight, then it's too easy to say, well, I'm special and somebody else is not special. But it's not all about comparing with other human beings. And the calling of God is not because he has favorites and he says, well, I'm just going to choose the people that I really like or love now, and the millions and the billions I don't care so much about, I'll think about them for later. No. There's no partiality or respect of persons with God. There's the best time when God sees that, and he doesn't make mistakes, the best time for an individual to have their opportunity, to have the spiritual blindness removed, and to begin to understand the truth of God, including the plan of salvation that God has for humanity. Now, there are four facets or aspects of this Feast of Trumpets. And we'll take a look at this and go through this. But to start with, let's look at some of the historical stuff for a few minutes. And the blowing of trumpets. Numbers chapter 10. Numbers chapter 10. This is where we read about the chatzatzera. The who? The silver trumpets. The silver trumpets. They play a part in the blowing of trumpets. Numbers chapter 10, verse 1. And the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, make two silver trumpets for yourself. You shall make them of hammered work. You shall use them for calling the assembly and for directing the movements of the camps. So here were silver trumpets, and they had a distinctive sound, as blown according to the purpose at the moment. So imagine how effective this was as a way of communicating with millions of people as Israel's history continued, or we look at its history, as they grew larger and larger. But even at the time of the Exodus, there are estimates that there may have been 1.5 million to 2 million or whatever. But you imagine now, how is an effective way of reaching a huge group of people? You can hear the sound of a trumpet from a long distance away. We had neighbors that heard the trumpet from the household where I grew up. Unfortunately, I wasn't blowing it. So a couple of others. My dad played that, and the one sister that I have, she played the trumpet, played the clarinet, saxophone, stuff like that. But the silver trumpets were used for these things, calling the assembly. So as the particular sound of that trumpet, just like, you know, in the militaries of different nations, especially our nation over the years, they developed certain sounds, you know, and this meant this, and that sound and series of notes and stanzas, all that stuff meant something else. You hear the sound and you know what it means. It means time to break camp, and you're going to go, you know. And they had their marching orders, didn't they? So it was not mass confusion. And they went tribe by tribe by tribe. And when they encamped, they had precise organization again. So, and then it says, calling the assembly and for directing the movement of the camps. When they blow both of them, all the assembly shall gather before you at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. So here's the signal. Okay, what do I hear? Oh, I hear both of these messages. This is what we're supposed to do. But if they blow only one, then the leaders, the heads of the divisions of Israel, shall gather to you. In verse 8, the sons of Aaron, the priests, shall blow the trumpets, and these shall be to you as an ordinance forever throughout your generation. And when you go to war in your land against the enemy who oppresses you, think of the point at which God was telling them this. They were wandering in the wilderness for a period that lasted 40 years. And God knew what lay ahead. Just one little indication here in this passage. He says, and when you go to war in your land, they were currently at the time of Book of Numbers in the wilderness, but not yet in the Promised Land, against the enemy who oppresses you, then you shall sound an alarm with the trumpets, and you will be remembered before the Eternal your God, and you will be saved from your enemies. Wow. So much about blowing the trumpets. Let's turn to Jeremiah chapter 4. This gives us an illustration of this alarm of war, where it's being discussed. And we've talked about the Tshatzara, that is the silver trumpet. So that was for the moving of the camp and the assembling and the instructions like that. But this alarm of war involved a different trumpet, one that made a piercing blast, and that's the shofar, the ram's horn. And when they heard the sound of the shofar, you know, if you heard me play it, you'd think a cow is just in the process of dying because of best imitation I can give. You know, didn't see too many cows die, more sheep than cows. Nonetheless, not a pleasant kind of sound, but the piercing blast. It had to be attention riveting. And here in Jeremiah chapter 4, we have a bit of description about this. We just need to find Jeremiah. Yeah. Jeremiah chapter 4. Jeremiah chapter 4. Jeremiah chapter 4, the beginning of the chapter. Well, let's skip down to verse 5. Declare in Judah and proclaim in Jerusalem and say, this is Jeremiah 4, verse 5, blow the trumpet in the land. Cry, gather together, and say, assemble yourselves and let us go into the fortified cities. Set up the standard or the banner towards Zion. Take refuge. Do not delay, for I will bring disaster from the north and great destruction. Now, brethren, if you and I can imagine what would go through the minds and what would happen physiologically when they heard this pierce, this blast of that trumpet, the shofar, they knew they were in trouble. They might not know how impending that disaster was, whether it was a matter of minutes or, you know, the enemy was an hour away or just what. But they would know this is a difficult time indeed. And so we look down a little bit further here in chapter 6, Jeremiah chapter 6, verse 1. O you children of Benjamin, gather yourselves to flee from the midst of Jerusalem. Blow the trumpet in Tekoa. So here's, again, disaster, impending disaster, warfare, being besieged. And what a history that's replete with one time after another when this happened. Israel had trouble learning spiritual lessons. It's like their memory was very short when it came to those things that they should have learned from. And so they repeated the same mistakes over and over again and again. And their history is just jam-packed with illustrations of that. Look what happened in the book of Judges, a book that covers something like 300 to 325 years, apparently. And time after time after time, they made the same mistake. They turned away from God, from His instructions, from His Sabbath day, from obeying Him in regard to all of His instructions and commandments. And so God would allow them, or He would send them, into captivity. Nations surrounding them were only too eager to gain the upper hand. The Philistines. Remember the time of David, there were always more Philistines to be killed, right? I mean, they're all over the place. And that, well, what about Samson back in the book, in the mid part of the book of Judges, and how many he encountered? But the surrounding nations God used as nations to punish Israel for their disobedience. And so it's quite a story. Now, you know, we could truncate through many other examples of this and just go scan down through history, but I think that's sufficient to review the silver trumpets, you know, and gathering the assembly together and giving indications when it's time to break camp and to move on and to march. We see a kind of a culmination of some of this, the story in Joshua, about the destruction of Jericho. Seven priests blew on seven trumpets of ram's horns. Now, I'm trying to imagine, because one blast on the ram's horn can get your attention, especially if you're fairly close. Imagine that. Years ago, I had a fellow minister, and I just played a little stunt on him on trumpets. Some of you remember that. And partway through my sermon on trumpets, I'd given someone the clue, and right behind where this minister was sitting, he stood up and he blew that trumpet, and this visiting minister, like this, you know. The guy's wife especially appreciated it. The minister, not so much, but, you know, got over it. But it is an interesting thing. And so the shofar, the ram's horn, produced a loud blast, and that's illustrated here in Joshua chapter 6 about the destruction of Jericho. Psalm 81, verse 3. Now, if you need any earplugs, you better prepare. Because here in Psalm 83, it says, blow the trumpet, that's the ram's horn, the shofar, at the time of the new moon, at the full moon, and on our solemn feast day. For this is a statute for Israel and a law for the God of Jacob. Okay, the sound of the shofar, the ram's horn. Woo! Good job! Sounds so much better than a cow that's in the process of dying, you know. And you have that, I'm sure, I don't think that's an English word, but, you know, you just know how to get that support and that resounding sound. Thank you very much, Luke. Appreciate that. Joel chapter 2, verse 1, a call to repentance. Joel. Where did Joel go? Right after Hosea, right? There we go. Joel chapter 2, verse 1. Blow the trumpet in Zion. Sound an alarm. So here's the shofar again, the ram's horn. Sound the alarm. Remember we read back in Numbers chapter 10. Here's the distinction. The shofar, the ram's horn, is an alarm. Blow the trumpet in Zion and sound the alarm in my holy mountain. Now, it's interesting that Zion, location, Zion is a descriptive term historically, and you could say for today and the future, but Zion can also refer to the church at times and what the church is to do. We'll probably come a culmination of some of these elements in a number of these passages, but here it's talking in particular about a huge event that lies ahead. Let all inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the eternal is coming. What does the day of the eternal, or the day of the Lord, mean? That's a time of God's intervention. And the blowing of trumpets has a lot of announcing to do in regard to God's intervention. We won't take the time. Didn't plan to take the time, couldn't do it justice, to go through all of that, such as in the book of Revelation, again, starting back in chapter 5, chapter 6, 7, and 8, and a little bit into chapter 9, especially those chapters where it talks about those trumpets and talks about the ominous events that are going to unfold as leading up to the dramatic return of Messiah, Jesus Christ, to this earth. Down in verse 15 of Joel, same chapter, Joel chapter 2, verse 15, blow the trumpet in Zion, consecrate a fast, gather the people, sanctify the congregation, assemble the elders, gather the children and the nursing babies, let the bridegroom go out from his chamber and the bride from her dressing room. I mean, this takes precedence of great importance. Isaiah chapter 27. Isaiah chapter 27. Here's something coming in the future. This will be a time of rejoicing, a time of tears. You know, the Feast of Trumpets is a dichotomy. Why? What's a dichotomy and how does that have anything to do with the Feast of Trumpets? Well, it's a huge contrast because for some people, the events that will culminate in the second coming of Messiah, Jesus Christ, will be a time of tremendous rejoicing for God's people who are awaiting that. But for so many other people, it is a time of horrible destruction, a time of fear, time of anguish. So here's the dichotomy. You know, is it a day of rejoicing or is it a day of terror? Depends on the vantage point, as we call it. Where you are, what your attitude is, whether God's calling you or whether you're responding to God's calling or not, or factors such as that. The meaning of this day has much to do with our attitude. Because attitude is indicative, isn't it? I think I've mentioned before, maybe more than a time or two, that one of my major lessons years ago upon entering college is to learn more about the importance of attitude. Now, I don't know that I thought this. I've heard someone else say that later, that everybody has attitudes. Mine just all happen to be bad. I don't think that was an original thing for me. But, you know, if I struggle with my attitude, it took me more than a couple of days to become perfect in making my bed. Well, I didn't become perfect, but you know, my dorm room monitor could flip a coin, and it had the right result. The first day or two, he said, good effort, but you don't quite have it yet in the corners of your bed and all this. So he was pretty strict on that. But by the end of the week, I was beginning to catch on. Now, the attitude, a little bit more gradually as it began to adjust and the change and began to realize, you know, a bad attitude doesn't get you anywhere that's good, does it? It gets to some place that's bad. So attitude adjustment is the term that used to be around some years ago. But in Isaiah chapter 27. Still in Jeremiah, so that's not going to cut it with what Isaiah says. Can be rectified. Isaiah chapter 27, verse 13. Isaiah 27, verse 13. So it shall be in that day that the great trumpet will be blown. A lot of distinctions as you go through the verses in different parts of the Bible about the sounding of a trumpet. Which one? When? That the great trumpet will be blown, and they will come who are about to perish in the land of Assyria. And they who are outcasts in the land of Egypt. And they shall worship the Eternal in the holy mountain at Jerusalem. This is referenced in other passages, and it's a second Exodus. You know, the first Exodus, or the original Exodus, was the nation of Israel or tribes of Israel going out of Egypt, the time of Moses. But there's a second Exodus, and that is as Messiah returns. They are released from their bondage, from their captivity, and they are brought back to the original home of their ancestors. To be taught, to be comforted. Those who survive the figurative hell on earth that will precede that sounding of the great trumpet. Those who are in that captivity, they will be brought back, and they will be both weeping and rejoicing. Rejoicing because their captivity is over and because they're being rescued. But weeping because of the emotional aspect of that. Many of them probably will have lost family, close friends, people that they've known very well. Hard to imagine some of those things. Matthew chapter 24, Jesus Christ predicted, you know, his disciples asked him, you know, sitting there in the Mount of Olives, and he came to him, they said, well, tell us, what will be the sign of your coming in the end of the age? Not that they wanted to know too much, huh? Well, they were concerned. They wanted to know, what's the plan? Wouldn't you and I want to know, okay, what do we do now? What's the plan? And so he answered them, but probably not in the manner of specifics that they had hoped for. But he gave a list of events, a sequence of events, and especially zeroing in then to the end time. But there have been a lot of things that had been precursors. A lot of times in history, and you can read back even, you know, 100 or 200 years ago, or a little over 1,000 years ago when time, as they were recording it, you know, said, here comes the year 1000 A.D. And some said, hey, this has great significance. This has got to be it. End of the world, some said. Others might have thought, you know, Messiah will return at this time. And so we know, we read that, you know, Apostle Paul said, we who are alive and remain, when he was talking about the return of Jesus Christ and the resurrection to immortality. So Paul, who was, as he said, called later than the original disciples and all, and the others too, they did not know the precise number of years till Christ would return. And verse 31 here in Matthew chapter 24, and he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet. Now, the Greek is salpizo, looks like reasonably close facsimile to the pronunciation. S-A-L-P-I-D-Z-O in our letters for the Greek word. That's the equivalent, from what I read, to the word in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word shofar. So it's talking about the ram's horn here in Matthew chapter 24, verse 31. And they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Now, what an amazing thing, an event that will be. Now, I've said a little bit earlier about four facets of the Feast of Trumpets. The first one is a distinction about trumpets being the focal, pivotal holy day that bridges the gap, that takes us from dealing, first of all, earlier with the first fruits and the preparation of them, to now shifting the focus to what God is going to do in his plan for the rest of humanity. How he is going to turn his focus to them. That begins then with the Feast of Trumpets and its manifold meaning. So a Feast of Trumpets is a portent or a warning, and that's a second one. Verse 1, that Feast of Trumpets is focal, pivotal, holy day, when the focus changes from the spring harvest to those to be in the fall harvest. The second one is that it's a portent, it's a warning of impending war. It's an aspect then that distinguishes this holy day from the rest of the annual festivals, that there's this element that is very much a part of it. A third aspect, the Feast of Trumpets is a very clear, we could call it a clarion call to do the work of God. Now that's twofold. You know, we can focus on one and neglect the other, or we can do the opposite, you know, with them, and it's not right. Because there is a collective work to be done, all right. But if we're doing that, but we are somewhat oblivious to the fact that God has a work in us to prepare us spiritually. That it's not just saying, look what we know, world. If you could only be like we are. Whoa. You know, when we take a closer look, maybe it would be, if you could only be like we are striving to become. Because God isn't finished with us. No matter how many years, you know, He's been working with us, yet there's more to be done. But we have to be willing to see that. If we begin to rest on our laurels and say, you know what? I've got it made. You know, get a kind of a Pharisaical attitude like the illustration that Christ gave, you know, the Pharisee. He said, you know, God, I'm a great one. In so many words. He said, I give tithes of all that I possess. I fast twice in the week. I, you know, full of himself. And then at the same time, he looks down with derision, you know, on the way here. Here's this tax collector, publican. He said, not like other men are, like this guy. He missed the whole picture spiritually. So we must not let that happen. And so we need to have a love for humanity. Instead of a judgment to condemn them, that doesn't mean that we say that sin is not sin. I'm not talking about that at all. It's just that we are not the judge. God will take care of it in the passage of time. We should not participate with others in their sin. That's wrong. We should let our light shine spiritually. So they would say something like, well, how do you handle stress? You know, some of us would say, well, I don't do a very good job. Well, maybe we all need to do much better job with God's help. So the Feast of Trumpets is this call to do the work of God. Amos 3, verse 7. Interesting principle, isn't it? Where God said, you know, I will not do anything except I reveal to my servants. I'm just paraphrasing that because I disappear in 5 minutes with the time frame here. So, what does a minister do when he's in a hurry? I don't know. Amos 3, verse 7, anyway. It's an interesting principle. God says that He does provide a warning. What did He do in the time of Noah? And Jesus Christ, you know, referenced the time of Noah. He says, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the time of the coming of the Son of Man. Lots of things. The violence, the crime, humanity just at war with one another, needing a fresh start. And the world is headed, hurtling in that direction more and more, isn't it? So events, whether they take a few years or more than a few years, we don't know precisely, but events will eventually culminate in such a way that these scary things that we read about in passages in Revelation come before our eyes. But you know, the work that you and I have a part in doing collectively, that's a tiny amount of what God will see done. Now, it can all add up, and each of us have the work that we can allow to be done in our lives to set an example representing God's people and in growing spiritually. But Revelation chapter 11 talks about two individuals. It doesn't say their name is Tom or their name is Henry or their name is this or that. Nor does it seem to give any indication that volunteers are now being taken. You know, a list of volunteers for that. I think we have people that would say, choose me, choose me, choose me. I want to be one of the two witnesses. I got to share with you, I don't want to be one of the two witnesses. I don't want to be. That's going to be a tough job. Very, very tough job. And you would see in advance what's going to be happening when God finally allows them to be put to death. And then a matter of days later, resurrected. But the world will be focused on the work that they are doing from Jerusalem. And we live in a time, brethren, when that is a lot more feasible, isn't it? Because something happens in some far corner of the world, as it seems to us, and here's somebody with a camera, and they stick the microphone right like that. No, oops, I didn't mean it. Actually, do that. Anyway, they're right there. They're reporting. We're on the scene. Breaking news. The two witnesses today. I'm not sure they'll use that term, the two witnesses. They might use pejorative terminologies, you know. These two horrible people. These two troublemakers or whatever, you know. Like King Ahab said about Elijah the prophet. You're the one who troubles Israel, he said to Elijah. Nonetheless, it's going to be quite the time. So what the two witnesses will do will be an enormous job of bringing the attention of the world to what God is in the process of doing. Well, the fourth one, that was the third one, and the clarion call to do the work of God, and the two witnesses doing a huge part. And then there's something about angels, you know, and then their backup role in some way there too. In Revelation, but the dramatic, majestic second coming, the actual second coming, the appearance of Jesus Christ. And much of the world will say, oh, who is this? Maybe some will say, this has got to be an alien government. I mean, we're setting ourselves up because some have already booked their trip to Mars, right? How far away is Mars? Whoa. More than the fur piece I used to hear about down south. Yeah, this is in the law. I don't think they're booking any return flight, are they? Anybody know of any? I heard that it's pretty expensive to do that. Might be foolish as well, but anyway, things that human beings would try to do are going to come to nothing because Jesus Christ is going to return. And look at this passage in Revelation chapter 11. I referred to this chapter for the two witnesses, but has something else here as well. Revelation has time been lost. 1 minute. Revelation chapter 11. Think about this in regard to this holy day, this Feast of Trumpets. Think about the time that is portrayed, the second coming of Jesus Christ. This is perhaps the major takeaway that we get from the day of trumpets, is that it's all a whole lot about the events that culminate in the second coming of Jesus Christ and what he will do as he becomes Lord of Lords and King of Kings. So here in Revelation chapter 11, verse 15, then the seventh angel sounded, blew the trumpet. And there were loud voices in heaven saying, the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. Much more to this day, and we're going to continue after our lunch break with services this afternoon and have more for us to reflect upon as far as the meaning of this marvelous festival of God and Holy Day of God, the Feast of Trumpets.